Turn in your Bibles, if you would, to Romans chapter 12. Paul the Apostle is training his church on what a gospel church family looks like. And we will look at Romans chapter 12 today towards the end. We dealt with half of that early part of that segment of Scripture last Sunday. And we will look at the next portion of that here today. So you'll be looking in Romans chapter 12. And we'll go with verses 14 to 17 today. Let's read that together, if we could. I'll wait till you get there. Romans chapter 12, verses 14. We'll go 14 to 16. And what we're going to look at today really is this, that we're adopted children of God, and we are responsible to make peace in the church family. That we are adopted children of God who are responsible to make peace in our church family. Let's look at Romans chapter 12, verses 14 to 16. Bless those who persecute you. What do we do with people who persecute us? Bless them. Don't curse them. I wonder why he would say that. Don't curse them. Bless them. Pray that God will bless them. Be happy with those who are happy. Weep with those who weep. Live in harmony with each other. Don't be too proud to enjoy the company of ordinary people. And don't think you know it all. So we're going to look today at how Paul trains and coaches the church family to deal with people. And you may already know this, but the past three decades, the American church has been losing 10% of its attenders every decade. Let me say that again. Every decade, the American church family, the last three decades, 10% of the American church has faded away. I'm certain that there are lots of very, very intricate reasons for that, but I come across people who tell me, I used to be very connected to a church family, but then I ended up at some point or other kind of withdrawing because of the people. Or someone who says, I would like to get more involved with a church family, but I oftentimes catch myself kind of slowing down and putting the brakes on, and instead of getting more connected with the church family, I withdraw because I recognize that it would mean getting involved with what? Or who? People. And the two questions we're going to tackle today is, how does God expect us to deal with four different kinds of people? And we're going to try to tackle that in terms of, what does the Apostle Paul teach his local church in Rome as to the ways in which we are to deal with one another? And he doesn't tackle every possible scenario, but what he basically says is there's four different kinds of people that you're going to come across in the life of the church family, and if we are going to be a family, we're going to have to know how to deal with four kinds of people. Then, after that, we will tackle, how does God expect you to avoid damaging the church family? So there's four types of people we have to learn how to take care of, and then there's a way in which we have to take responsibility in that we don't damage the church family ourselves. So we'll get a little training and coaching, and then we'll get a little edification and exhortation, and it's going to start with this idea that we're a family. That when you think about who we are, we talked last week and we reminded ourselves that we're not a location, we're not a destination, we're not an organization, we are a family. And families are messier than destinations. You can leave a destination, it's hard to walk away from a family. You can arrive at a location and then shortly after decide you don't want to be at that location and go to another location, and you don't have to necessarily deal with some of the heartache that's involved in that location. Or an organization, you can just withdraw. You can just cancel your membership, no longer a part of that organization. But when you're part of a family, isn't it true that that family is hard to get away from? And Paul knows that, so he writes a letter to the Roman church and says, it's going to be hard to get away from these people. Let's learn how to deal with these people. And these people, of course, meaning ourselves as well. And when we're mixing it up with church people, we will all have different experiences. Some of you may remember the story I told when I was in college, and my first experience with friendly fire at a church family was visiting my friend's church in Michigan. And there was a district official who was standing at the pulpit, all suited up, and everybody had suits on. There was like a legion of doom in suits on one side over here, and then this spokesperson was speaking, and he was describing something. I don't remember. I was a college kid. I was just happy that I made it that day. And then all of a sudden, someone stood up and yelled, "Lie!" That's a lie from the pulpit. And then after a couple of words were exchanged, like, shut your mouth and sit down, he yells back. A whole segment of one area of seating stood up and walked out the back, and then another train of people walked out the back, and another train of people walked out the back, and I thought, yes, I came at the right Sunday to watch people fight. Who knew? This was only in college textbooks. Really, that's not really my reaction. My heart rate was started to imagine, right? Started to race, and I started to think, something is really, really bad. It was hard not to think about that for the next hour. But it got even more bizarre when we were walking out the door and we had to cross a picket line. There were people who had gathered on the sidewalk and were walking back and forth in front of the doors of the church building, picketing some of the goings on, who was forced out and who was corrupt and who's lying to who and so on. But that's not the best part. The most bizarre part of the whole experience of this friendly fire was receiving a letter. Do you remember me telling you this story? I received a letter that said, "We thank you for visiting our church family and hope that you sense the warmth of our people." The warm welcome of our people. So I handed it to my buddy who's from the church, and I said, "I don't know if you want to make a call or if you want to kind of fax this over to them, but the timing is really time to put a pause on the welcome letters, right? On the follow-up." It should have said something like, "We hope you survived the friendly fire and will ever consider returning to a church family again." But we have not necessarily experienced that kind of friendly fire where it's open and public, but most people who have been a part of a church family have experienced some level of friendly fire. How many of you would admit you've been offended or put off by somebody in the church family? They've said something, they stepped on your toes, they've kind of hit you in the ribs. But some people aren't just offended and put off. You know, some people are wounded, deeply wounded. And those wounds go on for years. And some of those wounds don't heal, and people don't recover from that. And if you ask them, "How come you're not involved with the church family?" it brings back all this tense emotion, like, "Because I caught friendly fire. And for whatever reason in which that occurred, or however you understand it, you probably know that it has forced you to bail out and block out. You've bailed out. You don't want to get involved with people anymore. And when somebody leans into you, you block them out. And the reason is because you've had friendly fire experiences that have wounded you, and you don't want to. You want to avoid causing any hurt to somebody, and you want to avoid taking on more hurt." I mean, generally, we tend to fear getting involved with people. Or at least at some level, we have some degree of anxiety about getting involved with people. Do you know, most people would consider coming to a worship service pretty safe, right? The dangerous part is starting to get involved with people's lives between services. That's when it gets more risky. And some people are content to remain as fans of the church. This is one of the explanations for the rise of the megachurch, is it allows people to participate in a church family and only remain a fan of the church. Which means they are willing to be gung-ho about what's happening, and they're willing to participate. Now, some people move along and they go from fans of the church family to friends of the church family, which means they're willing to participate. They're willing to give and help out. But there's very few people who are willing to become a part of the family. And the reason is because, this is my certainly one of the reasons, and that is because very few people are willing to get hurt. Very few people are willing to open their lives and let someone come in and run the risk of hurting them, damaging them, or otherwise causing them distress. So the problem is simple, though, that people, it's universally true that relationships are messy. It's universally true. And oftentimes when people are watching others inside of a relationship and it starts to get messy, they use words like this, "Oh, it's just political." But I've come to realize that what they mean is relationships are messy. They're unfair, they're inconsistent, they're up and they're down, they're erratic. And maybe this is the reason why people are animal lovers, right? If you have an animal here, not a pit bull, you remember, I'm not going to go back to that phrase again. Some of you are like, "Okay, let's talk about the pit bull comment, okay?" But for animal lovers, a lot of times I think people are warm up to animals because there's no risk of being judged by an animal, right? And if you have a judgmental animal, get rid of it. You know, just give it away to somebody. Sell it on Craigslist. Do something. Okay, now I'm going to hear that again. But if you, and you won't be mistreated by an animal, but when you enter in with people, when you open the heart and open the door and you start letting people into your personal life, then you run that risk. Now listen, here's the thing. A functional family will easily become a dysfunctional family if we don't know how to deal with people. If we don't know, a functional family will easily, and even without even knowing, it erodes into a dysfunctional family, especially when we choose to avoid people or avenge people. If we're avoiding people and avenging people, we go from a functional family, to a dysfunctional family. No more fun. Why? Because people now, at the risk of getting messy with other people in relationship, begin to avoid people that they're uncomfortable with, or they don't know how to deal with, they don't know how to care for, or they begin to avenge people that hurt them. And you might think, I'm not sure, Pastor, that might not be exactly how people deal with it. This is what Paul says. Paul says to the Church of Rome, you're going to either, don't avoid them, and trust me, don't avenge them. And then he goes on to explain what that looks like. And here's what he basically says. He basically says that it's a huge problem when you choose to avoid people. That's why there's this whole term called the de-churched. The de-churched is a whole group of people who have left the modern American church, or actually it's probably the global church. They've left the church, and they don't consider themselves church. And if you ask them why, it's because they're hoping to just avoid Christians. Just avoid them. And that makes them de-churched. Or if you've dealt with someone, or someone has dealt with you harshly, some people start to feel like the only real response is to avenge those people. And we know that when we're dealing with people who are hurtful, when we're dealing with some people who are just happy and we don't quite know how to deal with their own happiness, or when people are hurting, it's oftentimes easier to avoid them. But here's what Paul says. Paul says, you, believer, you, church family member, you are a part of the solution. You are to take responsibility for peace in the family. How many of you ever, you've had a circumstance in your own personal family, your immediate family, and it's kids and parents, and there's a clash, and you have been very firm on this. Just own up to your part, your responsibility. Just own up to yours. You don't worry about it. We must say this 10 times a day. Don't worry about what your brother's doing. Don't worry about what your sister said to you. Don't worry about that. Don't worry. You take responsibility for you. And this is what Paul says. You as the body, you as the member of the church family, you take responsibility for being peacemakers and helping to bring peace. You are a part of the solution for a healthy and functional church family. And there's plenty of people who just don't know how to deal with the different kinds of people or how to care for those people. And we have to recognize, and we'll talk about this a little bit later, that it's our pride that it's always at work. And what is our pride doing? It's elevating ourselves over people. And our pride is isolating ourselves from people. Let me say that again. What we're going to find is, Paul says, it's our pride. It elevates ourselves over people, and then our pride leads us to isolate ourselves from people. It's our pride. Promote ourselves, protect ourselves. Promote yourself, protect yourself. Promote yourself. You're over, and now you're out. And Paul is describing to us here that God expects us to take responsibility for the peace of the family. And I know one thing, when family peace begins to become disrupted, the very first knee-jerk reaction in most of our hearts is to kind of point out who is to blame and who's responsible for bringing peace back. We're responsible for making peace according to the scriptures. According to Romans, it's on me as a member of the family to help do my part and take responsibility for making peace. So here's what basically what Paul says. I'm going to really describe it in two ways, okay? Here's the two ways that Paul says we deal with our church family. We have to learn to care and live in harmony. We learn to care. What he means is God is revealing to us that most of us are instinctively aware of how to care for ourselves, but we need to learn how to care for other people. I say this all the time. Before you get married, you know very well how to care for yourself. You think primarily of yourself. This isn't true for everybody, but in general, I think this is pretty common, that you're pretty instinctively keen on how to take care of yourself. Then you get married and you realize that there are more people on the planet than just yourself. And a layer of selfishness gets kind of peeled away, right? And then you have your first child and the next layer. And if you want to just keep peeling down to where there's nothing left of you, just keep having more babies. And eventually you realize, I don't even know if I exist anymore. Only these creatures exist. My offspring exist. But what Paul is saying is that there is a, that believers, even though they've become born again and they've experienced new life, they need to learn to care. How does that work? How do I care? If I'm able to kind of live selflessly and I'm thinking about other people, how do I care? And then also, Paul says, you don't just learn to care, but you have to purpose your heart to live in harmony. So let's talk about that. We've got this in our notes. How to care for three kinds of people. We might even mention four kinds of people here if we have the time. But three kinds of people that we have to learn to care for. Here's what he says in verse 14. Bless those who persecute you. So we have people number one. There's people who persecute you. They are hurtful people. People who are hurtful. They are hurtful people. People who persecute you. And he goes on to say, don't curse them. Pray for them. Don't just pray that they'll get what's coming to them. Pray that God will bless them. Why would I pray that God would bless somebody who hurt me? Because God blesses you and you have hurt him. So God gives you grace and he says, pray for the people who persecute you that they would receive the same kind of grace that you received. That's what gospel people do. They say, God has blessed me, so I'm going to pray for the people who are hurting me and pray that God blesses them the same way he's blessed me because I have a level of humility. So he says, bless those who persecute you. Don't curse them. Pray that God will bless them. Be happy with those who are happy and weep with those who weep. We have three kinds of people. Pray for those who are hurtful. Persecution means that someone has treated you harshly. Someone has treated you cruelly. Now, let me make the distinction here. I think most of us are kind of prone to think things like, yeah, I've been offended a lot. This isn't offense. This isn't someone said something that kind of tweaked you or hurt your feelings. This is someone who has treated you cruelly. They have harshly treated you. Some of this, it's important for us to recognize these are people that have done more damage than just happen to say something to us in the wrong way that injures our pride. This is someone who's harsh and cruel. And God says that when you are a church family, if you want to learn to make peace and you want to care for everybody, when people are hurtful, use your words not to curse them. Use your words to bring them before the Father and pray for them and pray that God's grace would be extended to them the same way it was extended to you. How many of you are just pretty confident that if we just started there, if we just started with, I was going to say something that cursed this person that hurt me, but I'm going to stop there and I'm going to use my words to pray for them instead. Don't you believe that would go a long way in helping to solve a lot of the discord among any church family? I think it would. And so we're dealing with people who are hurtful. And by the way, I think this is just worth mentioning. Did you notice by any chance that Paul says, pray for those who are hurtful? He doesn't say, find a new church where there are no hurtful people. He doesn't say, listen, if there are people persecuting you, slip away and look for another local church somewhere. I mean, I think that's kind of my own modern interpretation of this, and I'm reading into what Paul is kind of saying or not saying, but I think it's worth mentioning that persecution that drives people from one church to another only drives them from one hurtful group of people to another hurtful group of people. And I think sometimes that is, I mean, by the way, I do think that there are times when the level of persecution drives someone away and for their own health. And sometimes it's generated by the leadership, and sometimes it's just a caustic, Christless family. But there is instructions here for us to stay and pray. Stay and pray. Pray for them. Pray for the people who are hurtful. And have you ever heard this one? I want to drop this one on you. It could turn into a cliche, but I think it's worth mentioning because it does have a lot of meaning. Who are the people who hurt people? Have you ever heard this one before? It's hurt people who hurt people. And I think as often as that's been kind of kicked around in kind of a bumper sticker way, there's meaning to that. The people who are hurting someone else, there's a level of hurt in their own heart. And you know what they deserve from God's gracious church family? Prayer. You know what they deserve? They deserve grace. and they deserve the same kind of grace again that God has extended us. So let's keep moving because we have a few more people to deal with. And then there are the people who are happy. It's interesting that Paul says here that you're going to have to learn how to deal with happy people. And I thought to myself as I first started to read through this, why would Paul give us instructions on how to deal with happy people? Here's why. Because our pride is at work comparing our lives with other people's lives. And when somebody has a happy life, we used to kind of guess maybe they have a happy life. Now we get to watch it unfold on social media. We get to watch where they vacation. We get to watch them drive around in their new car. We get to watch them swim in the new pool. We get to watch them, whatever their lifestyle is, we get to watch it unfold. And how many of you have found this to be true? That our hearts start this comparison process pretty quickly. Our hearts start to tell us, hey, they're happy, but it's only because. Or their happiness doesn't generate happiness in me. It generates a sense of self-pity in my own world, right? So what Paul is saying is here is that our pride is so overactive that we sometimes can't even celebrate with people who are happy. And the instructions he gives is when you're trying to deal with happy people, don't compare your life to theirs. Celebrate with them. Say, hey, next time you go on a vacation on one of those tropical islands, I'd love to come along and celebrate your happy life with you. I noticed you're eating at the finest restaurants. I'd love to come along. Be happy to let you order me something off the menu. I don't even care what. But here's what Paul is saying. There's a level of selflessness that allows us to get with people who are happy and not feel so self-pitiful for ourselves that we can enjoy the fact that they're enjoying something. And I think this is true. I kind of painted this picture that if you're involved with the church family, it's ugly and painful because people are people. It's not completely true, right? For most of us have a level of happiness that it is helpful when people get around and celebrate with us. To eat and celebrate and experience all of the joys and pleasures of life that God has graciously given to us, and to do it not alone, but do it with the church family. And God has intended for us to do that, but if you are suffering with self-pity, it will sabotage your celebration with people who are really enjoying a phase of their life. And we all know the difference between pretending to be happy for someone and really being happy with someone, don't we? Pretending to be happy with someone means you feel it on your face and you come up with a generic grin. But real celebration means there's a joy in your heart that wants them not to just be happy now, but to be even happier. And to help honor that and to help remember that phase of their life. Okay, the third person that Paul teaches us how to deal with is someone who is hurting. And here's what he says. He says, be present with those who are hurting. Be present. This is a tough one because if you've ever been around somebody who's weeping, now the definition of weeping is, it's basically this. It's in the scriptures, it says Jesus wept, and what that meant was there was a rage of tears. A rage of tears, right? There's a bit of anger with the sadness, and it is a very, very specific kind of tears, because there is sad tears, but then there's bitter tears. And what Paul is teaching here is that God is saying that there are some people that are going to be within your midst, in your own church family, and they're going to be suffering with bitter tears. Their tears are not going to be generic tears of sadness. They're going to be bitter tears that come from so deep inside. It's actually quite like this. Their inner life has broken at the foundation, and now water's coming out. And those tears have a taste. They're bitter. And these people are weeping. These people are grieving people. And I want to point out something that, how many of you already know, you already would agree, that there is a level of care that involves praying for someone. I'll pray for you. I want you to know I'm praying for you. But let me point out something here. Paul specifically says, pray for those who are hurtful. When you're dealing with someone who is hurting, do more. Do more. Because he says, weep with them. Be present. Empathize. Empathy is different from sympathy. What does that mean? Empathy is I experience some of it. I taste some of the bitterness. I am able to feel some of the feeling. I am able to suffer in some of the sacrificial, painful ways that the weeper is. Now, I've spent a lot of time with people who are grieving, and oftentimes when they kind of move out of one of their phases of grief, I say, hey, looking back, what meant something to you? Was it something someone said? And almost all of them say, I don't remember what people said. You know what I remember? There was people who were with me. That long after the trauma was gone, there's a handful of people that just stayed close by. And they wept with me. And I would say like this, because I'm trying to learn, what did they say? I don't remember what they said. They just were nearby. In fact, I have a list of things people said to me, and I actually want to hurt all those people, they would say. You know, there are things they've said, I just want to hurt. You know, I don't feel that they're saying to me. There's just people that have said stuff. And it typically ends up being the same thing that Paul is teaching here, that praying is critical. But when people are weeping bitter tears, there's more than prayer that's needed that God has offered within the church family to get close to people who are weeping. And it's so challenging to taste the bitterness and to feel the pain of loss. It's so challenging. But the closer you get and the more familiar you get with their story, the more you're able to empathize. You can't empathize from a distance. Sympathize means you understand it. I understand it. I know what information, I can picture and imagine what it must be like, but empathy means you feel a bit of it. You let someone feel, and then you experience some of what they feel. And sometimes that requires a lot of painful sacrifice on our part. And by the way, as our church family grows and grows and grows, you know what that means? More and more weeping people. More and more hurting people. What's our solution? For our church family to take responsibility to be present with people who are weeping. Pray and be present. And it's more costly than sympathizing to be empathetic. And here's one way to say it. Let me say it this way. Stay with them more than you say to them. Let me put it that way. Stay with them more than you say to them. And I think that's a good way to kind of understand what Paul is asking the church family to do. And you know, when there's people who are celebrating and there's people who are grieving, they need their church family nearby for all of it, right? Celebration, grief. They need their church family nearby. You know why? Because nobody is supposed to travel the mountain and no one is supposed to travel the valley alone. Mountains and valleys are intended to be traveled with company, with family. And if you are involved in your church family, you will have mountains and you will have valleys. And God is making it clear here that they are, when someone's rejoicing and when they're weeping, it's meant to be traveled together. And here, let me throw this out to you. True or false, it's the bad ones that make a church family sick. It's the bad people. I think that's false. I think it's false. It's not the bad people necessarily who make a church family sick. It's the good people who don't deal well with people. It's the good people who don't necessarily know how to deal well with their church family. There's always people behaving in bad ways that disrupt the family, but you can help prevent or minimize the damage. In fact, you personally can live in harmony with everyone else, and when you live in harmony with everyone else, you actually work to avoid doing damage to a church family yourself. Look at verse 16, if you would. Verse 16 in Romans chapter 12, Paul is starting to say, in general, he says, live in harmony with each other. Now, harmony, let me mention this. Those of you who are musical, you probably know this already, but harmony doesn't mean the same note. Different notes working together to make a new sound, a different sound. So here's what he says, live in harmony. Well, what is that like? He starts with now going negative. Paul says, live in harmony. Well, don't be too proud. Don't be too proud to enjoy spending time with ordinary people. Then he says, and by the way, don't think you know it all. So when he speaks in terms of harmony, he says, don't do some things. Don't be too proud. Don't think that you're so much of a somebody that you can't enjoy being around anybody. Don't be so proud that your pride starts to lie to you and you begin to believe, I kind of am somebody. And when I meet somebody, I'm analyzing them to see if they're somebody or if they're just anybody. And here's what Paul says. Your pride will tell you, you can't spend time with ordinary people because you are somebody. You can't spend time with ordinary people because somehow you are extraordinary. And what Paul is teaching here, God is revealing to our church family is this. Don't be exclusive and don't let yourself be the expert. Don't be exclusive and don't be the expert. Don't let your pride lead you to exclude ordinary people from your life. And don't let your pride lead you to be the expert on everything. And you will damage the church family if you somehow let your pride convince you that you're better than smarter than the regular folk. Did I just say regular folk? Did that just come out of my mouth? Where are we? I mean, what in the world? Your pride whispers to your heart, and here's what it says. You're extraordinary. You're extraordinary. You know more than others. You've experienced more than others. You've earned more than others. You deserve more respect than others. And this is what our pride keeps doing. You're extraordinary. Look at all those ordinary people down there below. That's what our pride tells us. You know why? Because our pride lives for our own glory and is constantly inflating us. And one of the ways it does it is to say, see those ordinary people? Don't enjoy spending time with them. Just tolerate them. Just tolerate them. You already know in your mind these ordinary people, I'm not going to really enjoy spending time, but you can pretend to enjoy it. You can tolerate them. And what Paul is instructing us here to do is to enjoy ordinary people. Enjoy being around people who are ordinary. One of the reasons why we have to enjoy being around ordinary people is because we are one, right? We are ordinary. Jesus is extraordinary, made himself ordinary to demonstrate life-changing, heart-penetrating grace to us. And then we, as ordinary people, get to share extraordinary grace with other ordinary people. And the minute we begin to think we're extraordinary is the minute we begin to reduce Jesus to someone just ordinary. Christ alone is extraordinary with overflowing extraordinary grace for us, and we ordinary people get to share that extraordinary grace with anybody. And we love people with it. Enjoy ordinary people. Don't be too proud to enjoy the company of ordinary people. And you can't really function well in a church family when you're too proud to enjoy being with just anyone. And when you want to be someone, you won't enjoy being with just anyone. And that is something we're all prone to. And you know what a part of the good news is, and that is that we have an extraordinary Savior. And we are the ordinary one. And he wasn't sent to make you extraordinarily better than anyone else, even those who are on the outside of the Christian faith. God didn't save us and rescue us and redeem us to make us more extraordinary than the ordinary people on the outside. Instead, he was sent to provide an extraordinary amount of grace. Now, why is this such a subtle but dangerous snare? The reason is because it's hard to identify when this is happening. Sometimes it's just a matter of I only really enjoy spending time around people who are just like me. Sometimes it's just as simple as that. And one of the things I've learned is that you might think everyone else feels the same way you do about everything, but it's only because you only really know and spend time with people who are just like you. And you're always in consensus because you're always surrounded by people who are just like you. Now, let me address this real quick, and then we're going to get to our last kind of group of people that Paul says, here's how you deal with them. Okay, let me really address this maybe hopefully briefly. That I think that one of the ways in which I've seen people explain that they've been damaged by the church is they feel like they've been excluded from a cliquey group of people. How many of you ever heard that, right? That's, they're cliquey, I was involved, but it is so cliquey, and so on. And I think it's important for us to make a distinction between what I believe to be friendship groups and cliques. Because if you think of friendships like the body of Christ, let's imagine that the body is an actual body, and that different parts of the people could be fingers on a hand. And by the way, if you spend a lot of time and a lot of you share a lot of experience with the fingers on the same hand, you will begin to grow in a level of friendship that's deep and heartfelt, right? And we want everybody to be as close as a hand is in the body of Christ. Everybody should spend time with a handful of people, get to know them, share their life with them, share experiences with them, and really, 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 really love them. And it's only possible if you just imagine it, just a handful of people. But a friendship, a hand, the hand of the body becomes a click when that hand closes. And now, that hand is not a hand that happens to live and love each other closely and share their lives together in meaningful ways. That hand is closed. No one is ever really invited in. Everyone else is kind of excluded. And this hand that should be a hand that serves and cares and still is able to maintain some level of health becomes a fist that kind of does some damage. And I like to express to people that when you share a lot of life together, you ought to get close like a hand. I mean, I have a couple of boys who are relatively close in age, and I happen to notice they spend a lot of time together. Sometimes they have so much fun spending so much time together, they can't even split themselves up to go to sleep. They say, "Mom, Dad, can Caleb sleep in my bed?" And he's got to come down from the top bunk and spend the night in the bottom bunk. And they spend the night together. And the reason is because they're growing closer and closer and closer. And you know what I hate to think? These two boys are getting clicky. They're getting clicky. We've got to break this up. Raquel and I have a little strategy meeting on how to break these boys up. See what I mean? So when a church family has a handful of people that are connecting and loving and sharing their life together, we want to see more hands of more people getting connected and sharing their lives together. And oftentimes it seems that people who feel like there's cliques are people who want to be a part of a certain group, and they may not have been excluded, but they don't feel a part of another one. And I think it's wise counsel for someone who feels like they've been injured by cliques, somebody who has excluded them, someone who has closed their hand and excluded them, and it has caused some kind of damage in their life. Sometimes I like to counsel them, if you're willing to care and share in your life the way that they have, you can generate the same kind of friendship hand that might last you a lifetime. So, in other words, don't start wishing that you get invited. Start inviting people into your life. Create your own hand. Sacrifice time, energy, decades of time in some cases. So, let me tell you this. Can I just share it this way? Be careful that you're not so in tune with other people's friendships that it generates a level of kind of, I don't know if the word is jealousy, that might be too strong, but it strains you to consider someone else's friendships when it's quite possible that they can't possibly take on any more lifelong friendships. Someone described it this way: every person is like a Lego piece. There's only so many caps on the Lego piece, and once that's full, it's impossible to take on any more and to genuinely care for them. So, if you've been injured, what you perceive to be a clique, be careful not to overlook. Be careful not to overlook. They're just as ordinary as you are. And sometimes when we have a level of insecurity or immaturity driving our relationships, we don't genuinely love the friends we have. We've got our eyes on wishing we were with the friends we don't have. And I think sometimes that can generate quite a bit of needless hurt and pain. And at the same time, don't we know there are cliques who close themselves off and they are exclusive and no one's invited in and so on. So we confess and repent that too when that starts to happen. Are my eyes open? Can I put my arm around and care for someone else at some level so that I don't close myself down? So, lastly, we've got to move along here pretty quickly. Lastly, the second thing that Paul says is that your pride will tell you that you're the expert. So you don't have to listen and learn from other family members. You're the expert. You don't have to listen and learn. No one can teach you anything you don't know already. So he says, and don't think you know it all. That's the way he puts it. It's a negative. It's a command. Don't think you know it all. Learn from other people. Well, what would stop you from learning from other people? Pride. Pride would tell us we don't need to learn anything else. We've already know everything we need to know. And know-it-all church members tend to only listen and learn from the people who think just like them. That's what happens to us. Know-it-all preachers frequently preach pet peeves and politics as essentials. They're not learning from people who disagree with them or who don't have the same politics or pet peeves. They are preaching at them. How many of you saw Polar Express? You know that animated cartoon movie? Do you remember that character in the movie who's the know-it-all kid? Anybody else just annoyed by that kid? And every second he's on the TV or on the screen, you're kind of thinking, let's just get this kid off the screen because it's so agitating and irritating. I think in large part that that's what we become as we live like people who know it all. And lastly, let's get right to this because I think this is important for us to cover. In just let's do this in just 2 minutes. Let's be honest. Within the church family, there is every kind of person. Every kind of person. We just talked about people who are hurtful, people who are happy, people who are hurting. And then we said, and then we have to take responsibility that we don't go around acting like know-it-alls or that we're unwilling to enjoy the company of ordinary people. But then Paul says something vital for a church family. Then there are enemies. Then there are enemies. Then there are people within a church family who are enemies. They come from inside, they come from outside. And by the way, if you have ever lived near one of these kind of people, think of it this way. Do you know the maniac neighbor that you used to live by or that you've heard stories about? The maniac neighbor who lives on the property across from you or next to you or whatever. And they're so irrational and so malicious and so evil. All they ever talk about is lawsuits and litigations and make threats and post warning signs and they're gonna burn your house down or whatever. Here's what I've discovered. These maniac neighbors sometimes they have a church family of their own that they attend on a regular basis. And they end up in the midst of the church family, and we have to know how to deal with these people. And someone who is maliciously evil, let me say this, maliciously evil, there is evil in their heart, there is intent to damage and destroy. These people use evil words or evil behavior, and sometimes it damages us. And maybe you're one of those people. Someone's malicious words or malicious behavior hasn't just offended you, it's wounded you. It has deeply hurt you. And here's what we have to consider. As God's family, we have a unique power. We have a brand new unique power because we're part of God's family to conquer our enemies. And it is not necessarily complicated, it's just not easy. When we're dealing with evil people, God's family members are to be the peacemakers. Listen to this, the family, the sons, the daughters, the brothers and the sisters, they're the peacemakers. God is, and God alone is, the Father, and the Father is the Avenger. I love that Avenger series. Isn't that so exciting? All of the avenging that's going on. All of the revenging and avenging. Here's what God said. In a church family, the body is the peacemaker. I alone, the Father, am the Avenger. It is my role to seek revenge. It is your role to seek peace. Do all you can to make peace with everyone in the church body, and I myself will avenge and revenge. And by the way, when you think about lashing out at somebody and avenging yourself, when you think of lashing out in some kind of anger, it's self-righteous anger. But then there is a Father who oversees our lives, who is a part of, who is the leader of our family, who has righteous anger. And any kind of payback you can offer an enemy is self-righteous in its nature and won't do anything really to do any real vengeance it won't bring any real revenge, but there is a Father who will one day pour out his wrath on everybody who deserves it, all wickedness and evil, who has rejected Christ the Son, and you could be sure that whatever you had in store for somebody to avenge yourself, God has 100-fold in the way that he's going to avenge his own. And here's the thing. We want to protect our reputation. God says, no, be honorable in the way you deal with your enemies, and God will protect his reputation. God will concern himself with his reputation. You do things in such a way that everyone can see you're honorable. That's your role. You be a peacemaker. Do all you can to live in peace with everyone. And you rest, 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 rest. God, I will not seek revenge. Instead, I'm going to do what I can to live honorably. I'm going to do good and let you be God. I'm going to rest in this, that as gospel people, we get to trust the Father in heaven who will take care of all the revenge that you could possibly imagine in your mind and infinitely more. To do what? To bring justice. Because that's what most of us want, right? We just want justice. We just want to pay back, just kind of provide our own justice. And God is instructing us that if we are a church family and we've been injured by malicious verbal attacks, or our reputation has been damaged by malicious backbiting, or our influence and integrity has been slandered by somebody who is evil, never forget, and we don't revel in this, but God's revenge smells like sulfur and feels like fire. It is dramatic, and it is just, and it is righteous. We don't revel in that, church family, do we? We don't revel in that. We want everyone to come to know saving faith. But we tend to suffer a strong urge to avoid or avenge people. But when you're in God's church family, our Heavenly Father is our avenger. And we do all we can to make peace with our enemies, and then we rest knowing He does all He can to take revenge. And that's how we conquer evil. That's how we conquer evil, and that's how we resist letting evil conquer us. Would you pray?